passing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Jim Butts from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reminisce magazine. Starting off today in the Our Lives section of Reminisce magazine, our heroes. One hitch was enough. His wartime stint in the Navy served him well. This is written by Barbara Gavlik Harnett of Swearersville, Pennsylvania. She writes, "My father, Leo F. Gavlik, joined the Navy during World War II because all his friends were doing it. He was only 17 at the time and still in high school, so he had to wait for his assignment. He chose the Navy because it meant he didn't have to sleep in the mud. But life on a ship was fairly monotonous. Dad used to say, 'They also serve who sit and wait.' And it well could have been the unofficial motto of his branch of the service. In the war, he served on the battlecruiser USS Alaska in the Pacific Theater. The Alaska took part in the battles of Okinawa and Iwo Jima, among others, where the ship saw action as a carrier escort. Dad witnessed firsthand the damage inflicted by the kamikazes, the Japanese suicide pilots. He was a sight setter on the Quad 40, a 40-millimeter quadruple anti-aircraft gun, which might explain his post-war interest in pursuing education to become a civil engineer and a surveyor. Dad brought back a few souvenirs from the war, including a rifle without the firing pin that he picked up from a pile of confiscated from the Japanese prisoners, and a samurai sword he bought from a Marine who needed money for a poker game. He also got a strictly decorative Chinese sword from a street dancer. It took many years before my father would talk about the war, but one highlight he liked to recount was dancing with Esther Williams, whom he said was very tall. The future astronaut Wallace Schirra was assigned to the ship for a short time, and Dad finally recalled a stopover at Tingstao, now Qingdao, China, where the Russian owners of a restaurant went out of their way to cook a Polish meal for him and his friends. Though proud of his military service, Seaman Leo Gavlik knew, even at the tender age of 20, that one war was enough for one lifetime. He was honorably discharged in 1946. Sent in by his daughter, Barbara Gavlik Hartnett. And some more in the wartime, World War II era. The infamy in the Pacific. This is a story here is written by Carol Catano of Buren, Washington. My father, William E. Clothier, was a 20-year-old Marine private aboard the battleship USS Nevada when Japanese torpedo planes and dive bombers attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Although he recently died, he was interviewed many times about his experience. He recalled that fateful Sunday with a cold feeling in his stomach. My father said the day was bright and beautiful just before 8 a.m. when he and a friend were dressing for church. That's when they heard gunfire. We had been undergoing several alerts, and we were sure that it was someone playing with the guns, he explained. Even after an officer came through the ship yelling, "General quarters, we are being attacked," he and his friends still thought it was part of a practice session. My father was on gun 10, and when he ran into the gun casemate, he saw a plane go down in flames right in front of him. His first thought was this was the most realistic drill he had ever seen. Then a burst of bullets ricocheted off the side of the casemate, and it became clear that this was no drill. We were hit again and again, and the ship started to sink, he said. A Marine gunnery chief in the station opposite mine had his clothes torn off him, and three men were killed by a blast. The chief raced onto the boat deck and grabbed a machine gun and kept on fighting. He was cited with the Navy's cross, with the Navy cross for his action. The bombed Nevada was sinking rapidly in the channel, and it would have blocked the paths to all boats if tugs had not pushed the battleship to the beach. With the ship partially submerged, men kept firing their guns. Others brought ammunition to the gun stations, holding the bullets over their heads to keep them out of the water. The captain's boat had been overturned, and he waded through oil-slicked water to reach the Nevada. His first remarks upon reaching the deck were, "My God, my God, what have they done to my boys?" My father didn't talk much about his experiences until 1985, when he attended his first reunion of Pearl Harbor veterans. This awakened a new interest in the battle and the history of his ship. The Nevada earned 7 battle stars and was the only battleship present at both Pearl Harbor and the Normandy landings. Continuing our stories about World War II in Reminisce magazine, one titled "The Day My World Changed" by Jack Doyle of Taylorville, Illinois. The scene that Sunday was familiar. Newspapers announced 15 shopping days until Christmas. Business was good, thanks to Lend-Lease, a law passed in 1941 that established the principal means for providing U.S. military aid to foreign nations during the early stages of World War II. Negotiations with the Japanese were at a standstill. Jukeboxes played Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, New San Antonio Rose, and Walking the Floor Over You. The sun rose gloriously over the islands, and December 7th would have been a wonderful time to explore Oahu, go into Honolulu, or stay aboard ship and write letters to loved ones. I was 21, in the service 2 years, and I personally planned for a day of rest and relaxation aboard ship. About 07:40 hours, I stood alone port side on the deck of the USS Tennessee, next to the USS West Virginia, looking over the shipyard that serviced U.S. Navy vessels, the battleships of the Pacific Fleet, the California, the Maryland, the Oklahoma, the Tennessee, the West Virginia, the Arizona, and the Nevada lay anchored alongside Ford Island. USS Pennsylvania was in dry dock, and the rest of the harbor was spotted with cruisers, destroyers, and ships of every size, a display of the greatest sea power in the world. As I thought about my parents and siblings, I watched a force of fighters, dive bombers, and torpedo planes arrive over the Koolau mountain range. The planes flew low enough and close enough that I could plainly see the pilots' faces and their fur-colored jackets with white scars. They passed the Arizona, the West Virginia, the Oklahoma, and the Maryland. I counted 10, 20, 30 of them, 40 of them. Although I saw the red ball painted on the wings, I still did not realize they were Japanese. Suddenly, I heard a loud explosion and saw dirt and smoke rising in the sky ahead of and to the right of my ship. Only then did I realize we were under attack. I was witnessing the first minute of the official entry of the United States into World War II. The planes had flown to the airfields, destroying our planes and hangars before returning to bomb the battleships. In the mayhem, I heard these orders: "All hands, man your battle station. This is no drill." I heard that message many times in the months to follow, but that first time will live with me forever. That was by Jack Doyle of Taylorville, Illinois. "A blaze of destruction," writes Sue Bishop Blake of Clearwater, Florida. "The morning of the attack, my father, Robert M. Bishop, was aboard the USS Tennessee. He had enlisted in the Navy on September 15, 1940, and boarded the ship the day before Thanksgiving that year, assigned to the fire control division. He still recalls December 7, 1941, in vivid detail. The day started beautifully, but at 7:55 a.m., Japanese planes flew over Honolulu, dropping bombs. General quarters, the readiness announcement sounded, and Dad immediately went to his battle station in the main battery plotting room, the most protected area of the ship. Unable to see what was going on, Dad could hear everything through his battle phone. He couldn't believe what was happening. The bombing was over by 10 a.m. The air in the plotting room was so hot that the floors had to be swabbed of perspiration. After about 2 hours, Dad was released, and he went topside to see the devastation firsthand. Fires were everywhere, and it was difficult to fathom. He walked onto the quarterdeck and picked up a star, which he thought was from the flag on the USS West Virginia. It was wet and soaked in oil. He also picked up a fragment of the bomb that hit Turret 3. He has since donated both items to the USS Tennessee Museum in Huntsville, Tennessee. There are thousands of stories about the men and women who served in World War II, fought, and died for the country. Let's turn now to a different area of the Reminisce magazine called Retro Replay. On the trend, the title of the story is Shedding the Penny Loafers. Miniskirts Came with Maxi Coolness by Frances Ann Smith of Tiffin, Ohio. She writes, Hello, Age of Aquarius. As a fashion entered a new era in 1966, I was there to greet it. I was sweet 16 living in Fremont, Ohio, and witnessing the birth of the miniskirt, the standard fare at the time, below the knee, accordion pleated skirts with white anklets and penny loafers, was a drag. The look did nothing for a girl's legs, and that getup made me look and feel clunky. Of course, my parents liked saddle shoes they never wore out, and to be fair, roller skates clamped onto the thick soles of saddle shoes much better than a pair of flimsy kids. But I was thrilled to ditch those dull duds, I should say. I was ready for some sharp threads, welcome miniskirts, silky pantyhose, and saucy pumps. I remember TV interviews with the Beatles and their wives or girlfriends. I watched intently with my mom because, after all, those girls had Beatles to kiss. I was taken in by their cool English accents and the shimmery lipstick. They had straight hair, spidery false eyelashes, psychedelic and paisley swirled mini dresses, and flirty pumps. They got my attention. There was something really cool about the London look. It was hip, and I wanted it too. Bold colored minis and kicky shoes were for me. After years of being called Daddy Longlegs by my neighbor, I had finally arrived. Of course, back then, swinging meant free and fun and harmless. High school juniors wearing thigh-high miniskirts could make a principal's toupee spin. I wore minis to school, but then unrolled my skirt in the girls' room to avoid being sent home. My rule of thumb, the mini was just right if my fingertips barely touched the hem when I stood up straight. So there's a picture here in the magazine with three young girls carrying signs. One says, mini skirts forever, and doors unfair. And I can't, the old one is so far back I can't read it, but they're members of the British Society for the Protection of Miniskirts who took the streets to protest in 1966 outside the House of Dior in London, England, after the designer removed miniskirts from its runway collection. And here's a little sidebar here. The lowdown on skirt lengths says ride the wave of fashion and hemlines along with eyebrows rise and fall, making front page headlines. So here it goes. 1900s, floor-length skirts were fluid and hourglass-shaped. In the 1910s, crinolines raised skirts just above the ankle. The 1920s, flapper styles were shorter and shapeless, but less restrictive. In the 1930s, pre-war lengths dropped to mid-calf or floor length. In the 1940s, wartime rationing hiked utility styles to the knee length. In the 1950s, indulgent fabrics and circular skirts redefined waistlines. In the 1960s, minis ushered in youth culture and street fashion. In the 1970s, long peasant skirts made boho-style chic. In the 1980s, volume ruled in size, shape, fabric, and color. In the 1990s, super short was super in, whether pleated or plaid or miniskirt suits. 2000, minimalism and denim micro-minis were hot. And 2010s, long and straight or short and swingy, personal style took hold. So where were you growing up? What category from that era, from the 30s, 40s, on up until today, what the styles might be? Now for our South Carolina natives, here's a story that's called Their Product Had a Short Shelf Life and the Buyer Could Smell a Bargain. Down the street in my old neighborhood in Darlington, South Carolina, was a pond where one day in the summer of 1976, my friend Danny and I decided to try rig fishing. I'd read about the technique in Field and Stream. You attach a baited line to an overhanging tree branch, and when the fish hits the line, it sets the hook. We baited the rig line with a smaller fish and bided our time upstream. Meanwhile, Danny's brother David showed up with a couple of his friends. They weren't at all interested in our fishing experiment, that is, until it worked. With a loud bam, the tree limb slapped the water with the weight of a huge fish that was splashing wildly. We managed to get it onto the bank and saw that it was a mudfish, or bowfin, as some call it, as long as my leg. One of the boys suggested we sell it in town. Some of the old locals love this type of fish, he said, and they know how to clean it. It's tricky, as mudfish are very bony. So Danny and I picked up our catch, and the five of us headed into town about a mile away. We hit a live one on the first place we stopped. "That's a good fish you got there," the shop owner said. "I'll give you $3 for it." He told us to divide the money five ways. "But Danny and I were the ones who caught it," I protested. "The other guys were just spectators." The man was firm. "Share or no deal." Danny and I thought about it and decided it was no deal. We lugged that smelly thing around town, store to store, the rest of the afternoon, and guess what? No one else was interested in a dead mudfish. So we ended up back at the first shop, where the owner was still willing to take it off our hands, but at a new price. This time, he offered us the grand sum of $1. Danny and I didn't even have to think about it. "Deal," he said. And while we're on fish tails, here's another one here. All snook up. This time, the big one didn't get away. By Robert Newkirk of Crestview, Florida. At 4 a.m. on March 11, 1962, I walked onto the old Lake Worth Bridge over the Intercoastal Waterway in Lake Worth, Florida. A tremendous splash got my attention as a school of mullet scattered. I made three casts where the mullet had been. On the third, I felt a hard thud on my line. A large snook stuck its head out of the water and savagely shook in an attempt to throw my lure. I tried to keep the fish on the surface, but too much pressure on my 30-pound test line could break it. The snook thrashed, got its head under, and made a quick run away from the bridge. 40 yards of line spun out in seconds. It came up again, fighting hard, leaving white foam on the surface. "Let it thrash, jump, pull, whatever. I just wanted it to stay away from the bridge pilings. If a snook of this size and energy headed under the bridge, it could be all over. Suddenly the fish turned. I wound as fast as I could to retrieve the line it had taken. I stayed directly above it, keeping my line tight as the brute down deep, headed under the bridge. My rod pulled down against the railing. The tip bent out of sight. The fish bulldogged toward the bridge, pilings, where barnacles could cut my line. I moved in the opposite direction, pulling as hard as I dared. Doubts consumed me. Would my hooks hold in the current? Was the fish hooked well or just in the lip? Would this be just another tale about the big one that got away? My line was stretched so taut I could hear it singing in the morning breeze. At any moment, I expected the lure to come snapping back at me. Finally, the snook turned and swam out from under the bridge. My back and arms ached, and my thumbs were blistered from applying pressure on the rod spool. After what seemed an age, though it was only scarcely more than 15 minutes, the snook surfaced, exhausted from its struggle. I guessed it to be about 30 pounds. I couldn't haul a fish that big up over the railing. I had to pull it along the surface to the end of the bridge, where I could lift it out of the water. Dawn was breaking when I brought my catch, its tail dragging the ground into Perk's Bait and Tackle Shop in Lantana to be weighed. It was 38 pounds and 45 inches from jaw to tail and a 27-inch girth, the largest snook I ever caught, and the largest taken in Palm Beach County that year. I've since had many snook fishing experiences, but none equal the thrill of that March morning 55 years ago. It's got a picture of that big snook. Wow, what a big picture of that. Nobody would have believed him if he'd have told them about that fish, I'm sure. But, yeah, good job there. Okay, we've covered war stories, miniskirts, fish stories. How about a love story now from our lives? True love. James Charles Vincent writes a story. She had her reasons. Two teachers learn a lesson about listening to the heart. One morning in late spring of 1979, I noticed an attractive young woman trying to enter through a locked door at the school where I taught art. I was 27, still single, and looking for a meaningful relationship. I called to her to try the door next to it, which I knew was open. Unfortunately, she was gone before I could introduce myself. As soon as I got the chance, I scurried to the office to get a scoop on this new person. I learned that her name was Susan Roach and that she was working as a substitute teacher. A short time later, I saw her down the hall. I approached, introduced myself, and invited her to the faculty lounge for a cup of coffee. We sat and had a pleasant chat. I was encouraged by our meet and greet, the fact that Susan had just graduated and was looking for a teaching position was intriguing. At the end of her first day, I waited outside my room, acting as though I was supervising the halls, when in reality, I was waiting for her to walk by. When she appeared, I pretended to run into her by accident. I suggested we get some coffee at a local restaurant, and she agreed. And we had another nice chat, and I got her phone number. When we parted, I remember feeling a special chemistry and a strong attachment to her. I figured I was just a phone call away from our first date. I waited a couple of days before calling and asking her if she'd like to play racquetball with me. She gave me a flat-out no, with no explanation or encouragement for me to call her again. I was puzzled and disappointed, and since I had a policy of giving potential dates only one try, things seemed bleak. That summer, in spite of my rejection, I just couldn't keep Susan out of my mind and hoped our paths would cross again. Months later, at school in the faculty lounge, as I sat with my legs crossed, someone walked by and kicked the bottom of my dangling foot. I was shocked to see it was Susan and to realize that she had had a change of heart. We talked, laughed, and really enjoyed each other's company. This time, after our first date, our fate was sealed. 2 years later, we were married, and after 37 years, we are still together. As our love grows, my wife gets more beautiful with age. Why did she turn me down for that first date? Susan was involved with someone else and wanted to give it a chance. Later, she told me she immediately regretted saying no. But the delay in our courtship was good because one of us may not have been ready for a serious relationship. As my wife always says, everything happens for a reason. How about that? Here's one spotlight. If I run into him, no mulligan on this chance meeting with a golf legend, writes Ron Metzger of Rockwall, Texas. Dateline, Atlanta Athletic Club, 1976. It was a U.S. Open Golf Championship, and I had scored two tickets to Wednesday's play. Luckily for me, I worked for a large oil company that was one of the sponsors of the five-day event. As a golf enthusiast, I was thrilled. Mom agreed to babysit our two children while my wife Jackie and I joined the spectators. Mom loved to watch golf on televisions on Sundays, so she asked me, if possible, would you get Arnold Palmer's autograph? Sure, Mom, if I run into him, I replied, though it seemed unlikely. Once on the course, we found ourselves in the gallery among a throng of spectators. I don't remember which hole it was, but we got to see Palmer's tee shot. With a slight fade to the right, the ball went down the fairway edge and rolled into the rough. The crowd formed a path for Palmer to take a swing out of the rough onto the fairway. Fans stood shoulder to shoulder on each side of the path with a single opening that a person could walk through. Somewhat bored and hoping to beat the crowd to the next tee, Jackie started looking at the course map to figure out the best route. She was walking as she read, so she wasn't watching where she was going. Meanwhile, I had stopped to take a look at Palmer hitting out of the rough onto the fairway. When I looked up, I could anticipate what was going to happen next. As if operating in slow motion, Jackie, never raising her head, walked right through the only opening between the bystanders and bumped into Palmer as he entered the fairway. Of course, she sincerely apologized, while Palmer looked at her as she was crazy. I started laughing aloud. Do you know who that was? I asked. No, no. Arnold Palmer, Jackie, looked totally unimpressed. I had told my mom to get Palmer's autograph if I ran into him, but as it turned out, my wife was one who had the collusion. Did I say collusion? I meant to say collision. Big difference there. Anyway, from 1966 Time Capsule, here's a couple of things. June 13, 1966, in Miranda versus Arizona, the U.S. Supreme Court requires officers to inform suspects of their rights before questioning. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jim Butts for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after our broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.